Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. In for Celeste Quinn, I'm Tom Rogers. We have an archive interview for our 1 o'clock interview segment, so as this is a recorded program, no phone calls, please, today.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a look at the progressive era and its impact on politics today. Listeners, I welcome your questions for Michael McCurr. He is professor of history at Indiana University and the author of A Fierce Discontent: The Rise and Fall of the Progressive Movement in America, 1870 to 1920. It was a time of great change. McGurr describes it as radical and audacious. Progressives launched a host of reform movements, including education, prohibition, suffrage, and labor. The power of government was to be used for social good. The title, A Fierce Discontent, comes from remarks made by Theodore Roosevelt in 1906. So far as this movement of agitation throughout the country takes the form of a fierce discontent with evil, of a firm determination to punish the authors of evil, whether in industry or politics, the feeling is to be heartily welcomed as a sign of healthy life. In this book, Professor McGurr argues that while progressivism achieved much, it is long over, climaxing and collapsing with World War I. And he says, quote, our politically disappointing present has its roots in that period of time. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Michael McGurr. He is professor of history and associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Indiana. He has been honored for his teaching and is a recipient of the National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship for college teachers. A Fierce Discontent is published by the Free Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor McGurr, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, Celeste, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
Sure. At this time in our history, these years, 1870 to 1920, class differences were huge. To begin here at the outset, would you give us some sense of the gap between the wealthy and those who were not?
Sure. You're absolutely right about the width of that gap. It was extraordinary. At the turn of the century, wealth differences were greater than ever before. It's at that time that you have the first billionaire, John D. Rockefeller, when $1 billion meant $1 billion, not like now. But at the opposite end of the spectrum, it's hard for us now to appreciate just what a large percentage of Americans lived near poverty. The fundamental point for me is that really most working class fathers could not make enough to support a family by themselves. The second thing to me, though, is aside from just the difference in dollars, class differences mattered because of those financial differences, people lived with very different values. The wealthy, middle-class people, workers and farmers, thought very differently about the world, and it's that gap that's so fascinating.
Yeah. On the one hand, those who were at the top were believers in individualism, and those who were not at the top, for them, individualism was, as you say, at best a wasteful indulgence and at worst a mortal threat.
Yes. I think, to me, one of the fascinating things in working on this book was coming to understand just how strongly working-class parents felt that they had to teach their children that you don't get by on your own in life. You really do need other people, and it's mutual attachments that begin with the family that are basic. That's very different from what the wealthy taught their children, which was that you could get by on your own in the world. And a lot of difference flows from that.
Yeah, so we have like sort of the cooperative kind of end on the cooperative kind of ideal on one side, and then the yep by your bootstraps on the other
mm-hmm.
side.
How were
the luxuries, the indulgences of the upper class seen by the rest of the population? Maybe you'd tell us about the Bradley Martin Ball.
Sure, it's a favorite episode of mine, and it's just about opens the book. The Bradley Martin Ball was put on by Cornelia Bradley Martin, a Fifth Avenue society leader, in the winter of 1896-1897, which, for your readers who don't know this, was the middle of what was then the worst depression in the history of the country, until the Great Depression of the 1930s, at a time of frightening economic deprivation for many people. And in the midst of that, in part, as she said, to stimulate trade, Cornelia Bradley Martin decided to give what she described, what her press agent described as the greatest party in history. And it was a costume ball that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and her publicist made sure that everybody reading the newspapers knew that it was costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it was one of those episodes that capture public attention and focus people on a question of a larger question. In this case, for Americans, it really was a moment that focused them on the question of, is it dangerous to have great wealth in America and great fortunes if it's going to be like this? It was all the more of concern to people because it was a costume ball at which almost everybody chose to dress up in one way or another as royalty, mm-hmm. as European royalty, not as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The newspaper reporters stood outside the Bradley Martin mansion on Fifth Avenue and counted just how many King Louis XIV went in, just how many Marie Antoinette's went in, and counted, as they said, only a couple of George Washington's. So to many people, it seemed un-American, and that wealth was becoming un-American.
Yeah. Well, down the street or a few blocks away, not far at all from the Bradley Martin mansion, was a family by the name of Golub.
Yes.
What was their life like?
Sure. The Golubs were Russian immigrants, Russian Jewish immigrants who had come in the early 1890s, and their life was a world away. And for me, I want to say, too, in writing this book, I thought that the best way to capture social difference and how politics is rooted in everyday life was to show the lives of distinct families, of real families. And one was this Russian tailor, Golub. His first name isn't even recorded. And his efforts to bring his family to the United States, and as seen through the life of his daughter, Rahel, who he brought with him to start making the money it would take to bring the rest of the family over to the United States. And her life was about denial.
Mm-hmm.
It was not only so far removed from costume balls and all of that, but one of the most difficult points in her life, and one of the most memorable, came at the time that she asked her father for a penny to go buy candy. And she was shocked by his reaction, by how cold he was to this, and how finally he handed her a penny and said, "Here, but never do this again." And she was so shocked she couldn't eat. And in the aftermath of that, feeling that his daughter was defying him, her father beat Rahel. And the lesson in that was that not only is poverty going to enforce a different kind of life, but you can't think about what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You can't think about your own desire. It's an intense story and a very disturbing one, with none of the kind of trappings of the Bradley Martin Ball that make it easier to confront. And this, to me, again, is a basic lesson of this period of history for us living in a society that pretends, at least, that class differences don't matter so much anymore. 100 years ago, the differences really were enormous, so enormous that a Russian tailor like Golub has to be willing to beat his daughter in order to teach her not to feel and think the way a willful, imperious woman like Cornelia Bradley Martin felt and acted.
Yeah. Also, in the book, you mention Frank Capra.
Yes.
Also, another immigrant. He had a tough time convincing his family that he should go to school.
Exactly.
Because it was, you know, you have to work. Everyone has to work in this family.
Frank Capra is a great figure. He's as great and interesting as the films he produced, such as It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Frank Capra, all the way across the country, in California, from Rahul Golub, really faced the same kind of reality and the same attitudes within a working-class family, that you were unlikely to get by on your own, and also that you really were very unlikely to get out of the working class, that you had to live life safely, and the safe bet was to plan on supporting the family. And so working-class families, especially Italian-American families, were quite ready to take their sons and daughters out of school and put them to work, and that was a given. When Frank Capra, as he said, hated being poor, he hated being poor, and you can feel it in his autobiography, the passion behind that, he demands to stay in school, and it produces the same kind of conflict in his family that Rahel's request for a penny to buy candy produced. What's interesting and tells a lot about American society would ultimately go, Frank Capra convinced his mother to go along with this, as long as he managed to contribute money to the family that he could stay in school and go to college. And he did, and of course escaped the working class life that he wanted to avoid.
Yeah. Now, Frank and Rahel were children of working class families, poor families. Mm-hmm. The Bradley Martins were wildly wealthy. Mm-hmm. What about the folks in the middle? How many were there, and what was their experience?
Sure. Well, the folks in the middle, there are really two groups. There are farmers and middle-class people. Farmers had been the majority of the country for a long time and were still, at the turn of the century, almost the biggest social group next to laboring families, working-class families. They sometimes lived in the same kind of poverty as workers. They're fascinating because they really had a foot in both cultural camps in America. Farmers taught their children that you had to collaborate with other people to get by. And when people talk about the family farm, that's what they meant, that it took a family to work a farm, even if you were well off. But farmers taught their children that they ultimately were going to be independent, that they would have their own place of ground on which they would rule, over which they would rule, and that it was possible to be free and independent in a way that workers just didn't think was so possible. So that's one group, kind of a cultural swing group and in a long-term economic decline, and the other is middle-class people who really are only about 10-15% of the country at the time.
Yeah, but they are the ones that really get things moving here as far as the progressive movement goes.
That's one of the things to try to argue, and there are going to be people who disagree. Historians have thought about it for a long time. But what fascinates me at the turn of the century, at a time when class differences are enormous and there are a lot of social problems, middle-class people end up with a surprising opportunity to push for change. And the key to it is that they had grown up in a 19th-century culture, a Victorian culture, it was just as individualistic as the wealthy culture, upper-class culture was. And what I try to describe in this book is how, through a kind of private and public crisis, middle-class people enunciated, to use a word that progressive reformers used, that the nation needed to be brought together and needed to be changed. And they're an extraordinarily dynamic element in the population, even though numerically they're fairly small.
Yeah. Well, with a foot in both worlds, too, I would think that they would want to move forward.
Yes, I think, especially when we've just talked about working-class life and the kind of built-in pessimism that many working-class young people faced, you know, that you're not going to be upwardly mobile. As one working-class leader said, moths don't really turn, butterflies don't really come from caterpillars. You stay a caterpillar. Middle-class people believed that you could make progress because in certain ways they were. Their lives were getting better. Their ranks were increasing because of the growth of white-collar employment. They believed that education really did produce a better future for you. They're very optimistic. That's the word progressive comes from, that belief. The title of my book is A Fierce Discontent, in part to signal not only how optimistic they were, but how driven and even how angry they were underneath about their country and what had happened to it.
Yeah. Well, thinking about moving forward, looking ahead, mm-hmm. brings me to ask you about a novel that appeared in 1888 titled Looking Backward.
Sure.
What a story.
It is indeed. Looking Backward is a utopian novel by Edward Bellamy. For any author, Edward Bellamy is in some ways what you want to be. He wrote this imagined book about a man living in Boston in 1888 who wakes up in the 21st century and encounters a completely different world in which every single problem that troubled middle-class people, from class conflict to a lack of consumer goods and enjoyment to problems between men and women, all of those had been fixed. And it's a kind of stilted novel, but it's so directly spoke to the yearning in middle-class people for a better world, a world in which there was progress, that it was an enormous bestseller, and it even inspired the formation of clubs devoted to the book and to Bellamy's principles. I don't necessarily want to have clubs, but that it's remarkable how that book really spoke to the temperament of middle-class people
yeah.
and urged them toward a different kind of future.
Uh-huh. The plot of that novel, the stories of Rahel Golub and Frank Capra and so many others that illustrate this period of history that are in the book, A Fierce Discontent, are fascinating. Would you tell us just a little bit about the research you did for this book?
Sure. I'd be glad to do it. This is, I think every author wants to make out his job is hard. What's tricky in writing about a long period of time and one where a lot of historians have done research is that on the one hand, you have the risk of spending your time reading book after book after book written by other academics and being distanced from, on the other hand, a real social reality. And for me, the breakthrough in this book was when I started to read people's stories, literally their autobiographies, like Frank Capra or Rahel Golub, who wrote under the name of Rose Cohen, and began to see that I could get more voices of real people and that they really would carry the argument that I wanted to make. So I read a lot for this, but I tried to balance coming to terms with all the work historians have done with finding the stories and the voices that would really speak to people.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure for me to have you find those stories compelling because that was the key to the book for me.
Yeah, I think that I've read recently a number of history books that are doing this very thing. They're getting at the stories of the people who lived through the period who maybe weren't the, you know, not the president, you know, not mm-hmm. senators, but people, everyday people like you and me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of, if I can say this, it's one of the things about the discipline of history that has made it weather intellectual changes really well. Historians are committed as a discipline to speaking to a general general audience. They're not as devoted to jargon as some other disciplines that I won't name. And in particular, by emphasizing the lives of ordinary people, we've really expanded our ability to speak to broad audiences and to communicate with them. I am proud of that.
Yeah. Well, also it offers us, you know, the readers of history, it offers us a better understanding of why and how, which is really what it's all about.
I agree with you. To me, it's not that you tell those stories, fascinating as they are, in order to avoid big questions, but because they help explain them. This is a book that ultimately tries to explain where American politics comes from, or comes from today, and I try to show that that is, in fact, rooted in very ordinary day-to-day intimate things in the lives of parents and children and others.
Historian Michael McGurr is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He is professor of history and associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Indiana University. His latest book is A Fierce Discontent, The Rise and Fall of the Progressive Movement in America, 1870 to 1920. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's get to some of the big questions here in this story of A Fierce Discontent.
Okay.
The assassination of McKinley, 1901, this was a pivotal event. Why?
I think so. In September 1901, most people know it, President William McKinley went to open the exposition in Buffalo, New York, and was shot by an anarchist, Leon Czolgosz, and died a few days later. It's a symbolic moment, a powerful moment, because I think for many people it was the point at which they realized that America was going to have to change. And for middle class and wealthy people, it was a moment when realizing that in the last 25 years, farmers' movements for change had been beaten back and various working class organizing efforts had been beaten back. I think it was the point at which wealthy people especially realized, with a feeling of sort of ominous apprehension, that despite their victories, despite the fact that a conservative like McKinley could be elected, that still everything they had worked for was in jeopardy, and that if that were true, then things were going to have to change. And that, to me, that really is the beginning of the progressive movement becoming national, and because it made Theodore Roosevelt president. Roosevelt, who, as you pointed out, gives this book its title, and who was willing, like any politician, to come to terms with progressivism, not buy it all, but bring it to the public floor.
Yeah. And what did the ideology behind progressivism entail?
To me, the most basic thing, the first thing, was the progressives' critique of individualism, the idea that an individual American should be left free to succeed or fail, to use his property in any way that he wanted to do. Progressives, having looked at the way in which individualistic rich men like Andrew Carnegie or John D. Rockefeller conducted themselves, dealt with labor, sold goods to consumers that might or might not be healthy for them. Middle-class people looked at that and concluded that individuals should not be quite so free. And instead, progressives wanted a different kind of balance between individual freedom and social responsibility. And what is so striking about the middle class in this period was that, knowing what it meant for freedom, they were nevertheless ready to draw people together, to associate them, and if necessary, to use the power of government to make them behave. And that's a very dynamic set of ideas that produced all kinds of change, from the prohibition movement to women's suffrage to the creation of the Pure Food and Drug Act, the income tax, a whole host of reforms.
Yeah. Well, what led to the decline and then the collapse of this movement?
I think the decline and collapse are right in the breadth of reforms that I just mentioned. To me, what I came to realize was so distinctive about middle-class progressivism was that it addressed the entire range of human life. And progressives, to get the kind of society they wanted, weren't just ready to have an income tax or regulate railroads or prohibit the sale of alcohol. Progressives believed they had to change other people, that they had to make Americans like one another, be much the same as one another, and be essentially middle class. And it meant that, as I said, they were willing to address a stunning range of questions and to believe that you could change people. That's a very ambitious agenda. It was too ambitious an agenda, as it turns out. And in the long run, too many other Americans were going to doubt that it was worth giving in their freedom in that way. Too many other Americans didn't want to live like middle-class people. And, of course, the progressives had to deliver, too. They had to show that those reforms could work.
Hmm. How is this period different? How is it similar from the swings back and forth over time, over, in particular, I'm thinking of our most recent history between liberal and conservative,
conservative and liberal? That's a good question, and I have to give a good answer, I think at least the start of one. To me, what happened to the progressives was a very sobering lesson for later politicians. Franklin Roosevelt, who served a progressive president, Woodrow Wilson, learned from what happened to the progressives that you shouldn't try too much, that it was too dangerous to demand that the whole range of Americans should change. And so a principal legacy of the progressive period for me is a kind of built-in political caution. No succeeding major reform movement, the New Deal in the Depression of the 1930s, Harry Truman's Fair Deal in the 1940s, the Great Society in the 1960s, none of them promised nearly as much and tried as much as the progressives did. And I think one of the reasons is the sense of caution after the collapse of the progressive movement. The other thing to me is that progressivism establishes the real dilemma of 20th century liberals, that in order to promote good things, whether it's environmental conservation or regulation of food and drugs, you have to be willing to constrain human freedom. And that trade-off is always going to be controversial. And it's that conservatives such as Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater exploited again in the aftermath of progressivism. That's at least a start at an answer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk with some listeners
Sure. This
afternoon. First, we go to a caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm interested in plutocracy, actually. I've got a couple of quotes here. One, for example, this would be a third one. Jim Hightower defines a populist as someone who focuses on economic concentration. Rutherford B. Hayes said, "Abolish plutocracy if you would abolish poverty. As millionaires increase, pauperism grows. The more millionaires, the more paupers," unquote. And then Theodore Roosevelt, which might be the most interesting quote, he said, "There is something to be said for government by a great aristocracy which has furnished leaders to the nation in peace and war for generations. Even a Democrat like myself must admit this. But there is absolutely nothing to be said for government by a plutocracy, for government by men very powerful in certain lines and gifted with the quote, money touch, unquote, but with ideals which in their essence are merely those of so many glorified pawnbrokers, unquote.
Those are great quotations, and I'm not sure I can do all three of them justice in the time that we've got.
Well, I was just wondering if you said that it's kind of like a middle class, a movement, and these people, you know, two of these people are presidents, and they were up there and they were rubbing elbows with the plutocracy, and they knew how bad it was.
Sure. Well, I think one thing to me about Franklin Roosevelt and his cousin Theodore Roosevelt is that they were brought up within wealth and had contempt for the culture of business. When both Franklin and Theodore Roosevelt, in talking about a mere plutocracy, are going right after business people and believe much more in aristocracy and the notion that it's people who are beyond wealth, who've been born comfortably, who, if they have the right kinds of connections to the people, are a safer bet. It's a very self-serving remark, but what's interesting is that really in that period of American politics, to succeed, you had to emancipate yourself from the culture of wealth. And I think in different ways, the two Roosevelts genuinely did that. They certainly were seen as traitors to their class. Other wealthy people certainly saw them that way. And it was their ability to stand outside of wealth and outside of class, at least to appear that way, that helped make them so politically influential. Another thing you said in all this is that we often talk about that period as if the big question was whether or not big businesses should be regulated. What your quotations, especially the middle one, remind all of us that it's wealthy people themselves, along with the corporations they owned, that were the challenge 100 and 120 years ago, that the culture of wealth, a life of leisure and consumption and an ability in pursuing your own free will to hurt many other people, that was what really engaged middle-class progressives, not just big business itself, but the way in which wealthy people lived. And the Roosevelts got that, I think.
And Rutherford B. Hayes, apparently.
Yeah, that is a surprising quote from him because he's seen as such a stolid president from the middle 1870s. But it is a reminder that the appearance of great wealth was really very disturbing in American culture. And even powerful figures that we would think of as conservatives and who were, like Hayes, very conservative, were nevertheless deeply troubled by what it meant to have men who were worth $10, $50, $100 million, and what it would mean for life in the United States.
Yeah, just for your info, I've got the attribution for that is his diary in 1890. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Thanks. Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line. Line 4, listener in Charleston. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Hello. I'm not getting any volume. So I can barely hear you, but I'll go ahead. I'm reminded of a gentleman, Thorstein Veblen,
mm-hmm.
Who I think approached some of the same subject matter that's being discussed. My comment and question would be that nothing has changed. We still have a wealthy class who have all the wealth and the power. We have a republic disguised as a democracy. We have a huge now underclass who can find no work. And then the service, I think we now are engaged, is it the last figures I heard were 80-20, 80% service work and 20% manufacture. And service work, traditionally, you know, an old English axiom, paid nothing. And so I wondered what your comments would be. And since I can't hear you well, I'll just hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay.
And thank you.
Thanks for the question. That's a good one and a sweeping one. Again, I don't think I can respond to every part of it. You started off by mentioning Thorstein Veblen, the pioneering economist who was most famous for the book he wrote that came out, I think, in 1899, called The Theory of the Leisure Class. And he was talking about the plutocracy that the last caller was talking about. The title explains a lot about what troubled Americans about the wealthy, that there could be a leisure class of people who didn't have to work, didn't have to live working lives of the sort that the vast majority of Americans had to live. I agree about much of what hasn't changed, as this caller said, and yet I am reminded that that upper class in many ways itself failed, didn't get the society that it wanted. Their style of life, a life that emphasizes leisure, big houses, boats, trips, and so on, they pioneered a consumer lifestyle that most Americans aspire to now. And they were successful in that way, but they themselves lived lives that were profoundly damaging to their own families, very high rates of suicide, alcoholism. It was very hard for those families to survive. So, you know, America is a very unequal place today as it was a century ago, but surprisingly few of those pioneering upper-class families who helped to make it this way themselves managed to survive in the sense of maintaining their wealth and their power. And America lives, in many ways, the way they lived, emphasizing the same kind of life of consumerism and pleasure. But the upper class itself suffered in the process. And also, again, it's not, our society doesn't have the sense of class differences that drove the leisure class in the first place and drove the progressive movement. That's an excellent question.
Let's talk with another listener, caller on line one in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I guess as you were talking earlier, I just came in at about 20 minutes into the conversation. It seems like that, I guess my question is, where is the state of progressivism today? Because it seems like the Republicans are so good at co-opting Democrats through issues like illegal immigration, welfare reform, homosexuality, gun control, abortion, and so many other things, it seems to just blow the wind out of the sails of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
Well, the progressives themselves got co-opted often at the time. Politics doesn't change. Theodore Roosevelt, for example, was very sympathetic to progressive causes and led the National Progressive Party in the presidential election in 1912, but he was always prepared to trade off progressive demands with those of labor and the wealthy and so on. So it's an old process. What I do think has changed is that the definition of progressive politics has narrowed somewhat. The progressives were willing to intrude in personal behavior, private behavior, in ways that progressives now would not. Progressives now would not support, say, prohibition. Progressives 100 years ago did and thought that that was as critical a reform as regulating big business. So there, to me, there are some large changes under the label of progressive and progressivism, and also some real continuities in the way in which the political system deals with radical demands for change.
May I follow up?
Oh, absolutely.
Doesn't it seem, though, that, I mean, just for basic things like health care and housing and civil rights and so many other things, it just seems like the Democratic Party, the winds have gone out of their sails. I mean, they just seem to be fighting to keep the barest minimum things that were considered progressive in years gone by.
I think that's true for now. I am so struck by how fast things can change in American politics. Been thinking for a long time, for example, that the present President Bush has been vulnerable on re-election, and in many ways he is. And there is an underlying anxiety among Americans about basic questions that you've raised about affordable health care, especially, I think, about Social Security. And those concerns ultimately are going to surface and need to be addressed. So I'm pessimistic often by trade, but I think this is a more dynamic political situation than we tend to want to recognize.
I hope you're right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk a little bit about the Red Scare that played a role in the collapse of the progressive movement at the time of the First World War. Do you see any similarities between the Red Scares of the 20th century and our current war on terrorism?
I see the potential for that. It's been the case often in American history that at times of stressful change, we've looked to scapegoat one group or another. That's what drove the Red Scares in the 1830s. People worried about Masons in the same sort of way. That the same potential certainly exists today. This is a society under considerable stress and anxiety and fear about terrorism. The potential is certainly there to blame other people, real or imagined, for what's going on in the United States. So far, actually, though, I've been struck by how restrained the reaction to some groups has been inside the United States after 9/11. But the potential is certainly there.
Yeah. Also, before we wrap up here this afternoon, I want to talk with you about the referendum and the citizen initiative. Those are reforms brought to us by the progressives.
Yes.
And so what are your thoughts about the recall referendum and gubernatorial election underway in California?
Well, I actually think that that's one of those times that human life conspires to make historians look good. People who studied initiative referendum and recall, which, as you say, were progressive measures that were pushed at the turn of the 20th century and enacted in various places between then and into the 1920s, historians in looking at those reforms have tended to argue that they would be co-opted by not so much the people, but by wealthy players with the most money to spend, and that they could turn into a very unwieldy way to try to shape change. Well, elections in California under recall have been susceptible to the players with the largest amount of campaign funds, and they have proven to be unwieldy ways to change things, which is not to say this election may not produce change and good change, but it is striking to see that, as many people have felt looking at the record, that recall election would be a very crude way to deal with what could be complicated economic and social problems.
Yeah. I wonder if Californians will rethink this tool that they have.
I would think so, or at least be more restrained about using it. It certainly depends on what happens mm-hmm. to the next governor and how well he or she does. But I think everywhere around the country people are scratching off recall on that list of things to do in their state.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, we've used up the time, and it's just been a pleasure speaking with you this afternoon. I want to thank you very much for being our guest this afternoon.
Well, Celeste, I've enjoyed this. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Michael McGurr has been our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is A Fierce Discontent, The Rise and Fall of the Progressive Movement in America, 1870 to 1920. Michael McGurr is professor of history and associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Indiana University.
And that interview with Michael McGurr and Celeste Quinn took place back in October of last year. It is 10 minutes before 2 o'clock on the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers sitting in for Celeste Quinn. We now have settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. With the Board of Trade settlements, here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you, Todd, and good afternoon, everyone. With the exception of the nearby soybean contracts and the complex of the meal, it was a red day across the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's get a look at the particulars. Wheat saw spillover pressure from corn and new crop beans and chart selling all day long. July wheat, a high of 356, a low of 348, settling 351, down 5.5. September, a high of 365.5, a low of 358, settling 361, down 5.75. December, a high of 376, a low of 368, settling 371, down 5.75. The March contract, a high of 381.5, a low of 375.5, settling 378, down 6.25. May, a high of 382, a low of 377, settling 378, down 7 on the day. Corn was under pressure from the opening bell on fund selling and a better-than-expected crop production report. The July corn contract, a high on the day of 285.5, a low of 280, settling 280.25, down 8. September, a high of 289, a low of 281.5, settling 282.75, down 9.5. December, a high of 290.5, a low of 284, settling 284.25, down 10.25. The March contract, a high of 294.25, a low of 289, settling 289.25, down 9.5. May, a high of 298.5, a low of 293.75, settling 293.75, down 9.25. And then the July 05 contract, a high of 298.5, a low of 293.5, settling on the low and down 8.5 on the day. July oats, a high on the day of 146.75, a low of 144, settling 144.75, down 2.5. September, a high of 152.5, a low of 150, settling on the low, down 3 on the day. The name of the game in the soybean pit was bull spreading, and the July-November spread widened by 29 cents today. The July, a high on the day of 892, a low of 868, settling 884, up 11.5. August, a high of 815.5, a low of 799.5, settling 806, up 6.75. September beans, a high of 707, a low of 691, settling 695.5, down 10. November, a high of 672.5, a low of 653.5, settling 657.5, down 17.5. January, a high of 674, low of 657, settling 657.5, down 14.5. And the March, a high of 669, a low of 654, settling 656, down 18.5 on the day. July soybean meal, a high of 286.50, a low of 279.50, settling 283.20, up 370. August, a high of 269.50, a low of 264, settling 265.20, up 150. July soybean oil, a high of 28.30, a low of 27.12, settling 27.34, down 77. And the August contract, a high of 27.45, a low of 26.50, settling 26.63, down 59 on the day. The settlement prices are also in on the Mercantile Exchange. And Tom, just a bunch of red on that side of the things is on the board today.
Pretty much. I look at only one commodity. The pork belly contract ended up on an up note. One lean hog contract, the nearby, ended up today. The rest of it, all down on the Merc. The August feeder cattle had a high today of 108.15, the low 106.82.5, settled at 106.97.5, down 27.5. The September feeder cattle, the high 106.10, the low 104.90, the settlement 105.15, down 42.5. And the October, the high 104.95, the low 103.70, settled at 104 even at the end of the day, down 25. In the live cattle, June contract, the high today 85.72.5, the low 84.45, settled at 84.75, down 57.5. July, the high 87.40, the low 87.40, all the way across the board, didn't move. The change from yesterday, down 70. August live cattle had a high of 86.35, the low 84.77.5, settled at 85.15, down 82.5. In the hogs, June lean hog contract at a high of 79.20, the low 78.85, settled at 79.17.5. That was up 77.5 points. The July lean hog, 76.25, the high. The low, 75.40, settled at 85.87 or 75.87.5, down 77.5. The August contract, the high 75.60, the low 74.57.5, settled at 74.97.5, down 117.5. And October lean hogs, the high 63.95, the low 63.15, settlement at 63.92.5, down 30. Pork bellies for July, the high 112.15, the low 109.70, settled at 111.92.5. That was up 20 cents on the day. Quick update now on the stock markets today. This afternoon, the Dow is up 64 points at 10,398. The NASDAQ up 33 at 2,003. It's gone above the 2,000 mark again. S&P 500 index is up 9.5 points right now at 1135.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau and IFB's AgriVisor Market Advisory Service. AgriVisor offers market information and advice on the web to Illinois and Indiana Farm Bureau members at agrivisor.com. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
From Redondo Beach, California, Jim Murdoch writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I've noticed a sign in my cardboard windshield sunshade that says, 'Warning, do not drive with sunshield in place.' I'd like to follow your example as an experimentalist, but can't seem to bring myself to try this. What do you suggest?"
Go for it, dude. What do you got to lose? Nowadays, manufacturers put those warnings on everything they make. It's just a legal thing. Their lawyers make them do it, even if there is no good reason behind it. I mean, how are you going to have any fun in this life if you're always doing what lawyers tell you to do? Besides, who wants to drive with the sun in their eyes? And when the other cars see you coming with the sunshade firmly in place, well, they'll cut you some slack and move out of the way.
Thank you, Dr. Science.
Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science CD and master's degree mouse pad, call 800-989-DUCK.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar.